Good morning. Please be seated. First matter on calendar this morning is it Sandra Ristolici? That's 67414. And if Counselor Ray, please proceed if you wish to reserve time. Is that something Ms. Chapman can reserve?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for the vote. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Cydia Figueres, and I represent Pat Sanger, the appellant in this matter. We're here today to discuss the prevailing market rule and its role in Nevada jurisprudence. This appeal arises from the district court's refusal to award attorney's fees at the prevailing market rate for Southern Nevada. The district court erred in refusing to apply the requested prevailing market rate for two main reasons. First, the district court improperly compared defense counsel's rates to those of co-defense counsels instead of evaluating the requested fees under the Brunzell factors. Second, the district court erred in limiting Mr. Saunders' attorney's fees to those billed based on the pre-negotiated contract insurance rates with Mr. Saunders' insurance company, despite having several rational methods to decide the reasonable rate at a prevailing market rate for Southern Nevada.
What is the prevailing rate here?
The prevailing rate in Southern Nevada would be the reasonable rate for the community in which the court sits, and our position in the district court was that the prevailing rate should have been what our firm would have charged in a non-insurance case. Our firm is pretty even-handed with our insurance clients and our private pay clients, and so for Mr. Guerin, the rate would have been $475, is what we requested. For myself, as a 4 to 7 year associate experience wise, would have been $275, and the paralegal rate would have been $115.
Counsel, let me ask you a couple. But first of all, this is in Nye County. I suspect that the rates are less in Nye County than they are in Clark County. I don't know, but I just would imagine that, considering the, you know, the relative wealth of the residents there versus Clark County, how would that impact it at all? You said the jurisdiction where the court is, so what's your thoughts on that?
It would impact the rate, and that's something that the court would have needed to consider within that community. However, as an attorney practicing in Las Vegas, I've had probably about a handful of cases in Pahrump, in our county, and plaintiff's counsel and the lower court, Mr. Lanine. He's also a practitioner from Las Vegas, and the co-defendants from Erickson, Thorpe, and Swanston, they're from Reno. So we think that the reasonable rate would have been run for Southern Nevada, given where the practitioners were, and that's where we would have normally been charging the rates, despite the fact that we would go to different areas in the state.
Okay. Let me ask you one other question. Right now, in these attorney's fees cases, we always refer to the Brunzell analysis and all those factors there as kind of a uniform thing we do. It doesn't appear that Judge Ronker did the Brunzell analysis at all in making the award of attorney's fees. How does that impact the case in your view of them?
Your Honor is absolutely correct. There was no analysis of the Brunzell factors that we can glean from the record. And so if Mr. Sanger had been represented or had been the only defendant in the matter, it's unclear what standard the district court would have used in awarding attorney's fees here, despite the fact that Mr. Sanger did provide three different alternatives for the court. Four, really, if you consider the actual billing, which is ultimately what she went with, but the reasoning was your billing rates are the same as your co-defendants.
Okay. One other question, and then I'll let you. We had, as you know, another case pending that is awaiting resolution, and that possibly could impact this case, you know, like that. Should we delay making a final decision on this case until we decide the other case?
Your Honor is referring to the concurrent appeal in the 6-8.
I have the number in here, but yes, because I know there was a request to continue the arguments, and I think the court felt, well, let's just get them done. We can try and wrap everything up on this. So I'm just wondering, should we consolidate them? Should we cluster them? Should we wait? Did you have any view on that?
We do have a view on that. Right now, pending in the other unconsolidated matter is Pat Sanger's motion for reconsideration. It was a one-justice decision, and so under Rule 27, Mr. Songer is entitled to review by the entire court, so that's currently pending before the court. As far as Mr. Songer is concerned, the only proper timely appeal in this case overall is the current matter before the court. So I do think it would be proper for the court to go ahead and issue a ruling on this matter. And if the court decided to delay ruling because of the potential for consolidating with the other matter pending the resolution of the motion for rehearing, this issue would still need to be decided one way or another, because it's evident that the district court abused its discretion by failing to consider the Bonzell factors and instead putting a much heavier weight on the co-defendant's comparable insurance rates or actual billing in that matter. And I should note that I think part of the reason that the court did that was the co-defendant was not only seeking to recover their attorney's fees, they were also seeking to recover the fees of the law firm, because those attorneys that were involved spent about $40,000 worth of time in helping to defend their own lawsuits. They were actually seeking about $60,000 worth of fees, and the court decided to just go with their amounts billed in representing the case.
If I can be heard, Madam Clerk, our timing clocks didn't appear to have started. I don't know if we're... All right, thank you.
So as this court has repeatedly stated, the district court's analysis in granting attorney's fees may begin with any method rationally designed to calculate a reasonable amount, provided that the party be entitled to attorney's fees under statute or by contract. This rational method includes, but is not limited to, the Webster method, where the court multiplies the number of reasonable hours by a reasonable amount, or it could be based on a contingency agreement. It just needs to be a rational amount. And so whatever method the district court applies, they still have to do an analysis under Bonzell, and this court expects the court to evaluate the following factors: of the qualities of the advocate, the character of the work that was done, the actual work performed in the matter, and ultimately the results. Bonzell does not list as a factor comparing one co-defendant's billing rates to the other co-defendants as a basis for awarding those attorney's fees. The court still needs to do this evaluation to see whether or not they have abused their discretion. Notably, Bonzell was about the reasonable value of an attorney's services, and the prevailing party counsel in that matter, they didn't even have record keeping. They had just estimated that the value of the work had been about $5,000 worth, and so then that's why the court went through this analysis, because what you're looking for is the value of the work provided. And so it should not matter if your attorney is a pro bono counsel, if your attorney is a government attorney, or if you happen to have the benefit of hiring an insurance company and being able to get those pre-negotiated rates. Because it's a fee-shifting statute, the burden is on the other party to pay reasonable attorney's fees, and so that's going to be based on the value of the work provided. It should not matter what happens with the contract agreement between the client and the attorney in determining that amount.
But it's kind of a windfall. You know, I understand your argument, but let's say an insurance rates for a case are $10,000 and the prevailing market rate is $20,000, and we say it's okay to do the $20,000. What happens to that extra $10,000? You know, where does that go?
The extra funds would go back to the insurance carrier and to the client, because the client still has to pay their deductible. And so that's part that is built into the attorney's fees. But it would
that be... That turn converts attorney's fees into damages, though, wouldn't it?
Well, under this statute, you're actually allowed to get damages, and you could bring it a separate claim, so 41670. Mm-hmm. And even though Mr. Songer hasn't elected to do so at this point, he still has that right to do so later on in the future. But the example of the prevailing market rate that really came to mind would be, say some famous celebrity went and hired the top-notch attorney in Las Vegas to go handle a juvenile justice, traffic ticket, small, less than $7,500 matter. That attorney, because of their reputation, because of their standing in the community, might charge $600, $700 an hour for something that really is a $200 an hour rate.
Unfortunately, some might pay that, others would not pay that.
This is true, but that's why the court would be there to determine the reasonable market rate for the value of the services provided.
Which comes back to the failure to conduct a Brunzell analysis.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Is that automatic reversal as far as you're concerned if a judge does not conduct a Brunzell? Is it automatic, like in a criminal case calling a structural error where it doesn't matter, you know, what the number was or what the number requested, it has to go back?
I think it would need to go back in order to see that the court actually did evaluate the Brunzell factors instead of what is clear that the court just said, your rates are the same, and so I'm going to keep it at the actual billing rate. And now turning to the second point of why the court erred, the court was given four options in determining a reasonable market rate. The first one was the Laffey matrix. The Laffey matrix can be found on the joint appendix on 888. And basically, it's a matrix that the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia puts together every year, and that's what they set as their standard rates for all of their reasonable attorney's fees. And courts outside of the District of Columbia have adopted the Laffey matrix as an objective way of determining the prevailing market rate.
But isn't that discretionary on their part? No other circuit or whatever is mandated to do the same thing?
No other circuit has mandated it, but no other circuit has said that it is an unreasonable method. I think most of the circuits have agreed that it is an objective means of calculating the reasonable rate, which is one that we provided to the court. And then there's also a way to calculate that rate for your region. At the time when we wrote this motion back in 2014, there was no federal locality for Las Vegas and Nevada, so we did a comparison of different regions of Phoenix, Sacramento, and Denver to come up with a rate. As I was re-reviewing all of these, Las Vegas does have a federal comparable index for cost of living, and so the rate at this point would be 14.55% above the federal rate. So you would adjust the Laffey matrix accordingly and be able to come up with a reasonable objective rate. And when you look at those reasonable objective rates through the Laffey matrix or through the Laffey's adjusted rate for Southern Nevada, the rates that the firm would charge on a private pay case would be comparable, would be about the same. And so that is where we would argue that the prevailing market rate would fall in for Southern Nevada.
Well, your argument is interesting. However, I'm a little concerned when you start talking about prevailing market rate, because as you spoke in your earlier argument, what an attorney is worth is very subjective in terms of reputation, outcomes, and how they're viewed or how the community views certain types of cases. So trying to bootstrap, so to speak, an absolute standard, it's almost like the dilemma of do we pay a minimum wage of $15 an hour in place. But looking at that, again, is that subject to the Brunzell factors from your standpoint?
I think it complements the Brunzell factors. It would be saying, here's the prevailing market rate that we think applies in this, that we, the Supreme Court, say, district courts, you guys can go ahead and use this as a guide, but it's not absolute, saying you must adopt the Laffey matrix or you must look at this number. It's you have to make an evaluation and determine what the prevailing market rate is for the type of work that's done. You'd still have to go through and evaluate the qualities of the advocate, which you have to respect. It would be a subjective matter, but you'd also have to look at the character of the work done, the actual work performed, and the results. As Your Honors undoubtedly saw, the joint appendix in this matter, now page 1 through 857, have to do with the anti-SLAPP issue, the substantive issue on this case. The district court had multiple hearings on deciding the anti-SLAPP issue, requested additional briefing. There were many hours of legislative research, review, and writing to make sure that the court fully understood what was being asked of it in this anti-SLAPP statute, and the court recognized that in understanding that it was a complicated issue. So what the prevailing market rate would do is offer, here's a guide, and based on the level of the work that was done and what was presented to the court, you could go ahead and adjust that either up or down, but you should not be looking strictly at the contract rate between the client and either its insurance company, or if it's the client and the pro bono client, or if it's the attorney and a government attorney. That relationship shouldn't come into the evaluation of where to set that prevailing market rate for a lobster method of calculating reasonable attorney's fees.
Counsel, you're just a little above your 2-minute mark. Time you wish to reserve?
Yes, I will reserve the rest. Thank you.
Mr. O'Leary?
Thank you. On behalf of firefighter paramedic Ray DeLucchi and firefighter EMT Tommy Hollis, please the court. This is a case of putting the cart before the horse. The court should not be addressing the issue of attorney's fees until it decides the underlying issue as to whether or not the anti-SLAPP statutes apply to contract vendors such as Mr. Songer, or whether or not DeLucchi and Hollis made the necessary threshold showing based upon an arbitrator's finding that Mr. Songer's report contained intentional material misrepresentations. Docket 66858 was the original appeal on the merits, which was dismissed after the court determined that there was not a final judgment in the district court. I would note that in the order of dismissal, the court stated that it had considered both our response to the order show cause and Mr. Songer's reply. Now, whether the court got it right or not in dismissing the underlying appeal is really not that germane, because it has to be binding on both parties, as Songer was a party to that appeal and had an opportunity to be heard. Whether it's under the doctrine of the law of the case or prior adjudication, the result is the same, that the final judgment was the one that was subsequently entered by the district court below. So until that appeal from the later entry order of dismissal final judgment is adjudicated, I don't think the court needs to decide the issue of attorney's fees, but I am prepared to argue them.
Mr. Levine, let me ask you, I believe that the other docket is 68994.
That is the current appeal. 66858 was the original one which was dismissed. 68994 is the current new pending appeal.
Okay, so that is pending. This is 67414. So we're
correct.
Kind of spread out here. So what do you feel they should be consolidated? Or
yes.
The other procedure we have is called clustering, where we don't consolidate it, but we kind of send out the decisions at the same time if one case affects another, but they may be different issues. So that's another alternative we could consider.
Whatever verb is utilized, the result should be the same, which is the issue of attorney's fees need not even be decided by this court if the court reverses the underlying order granting the special motion to dismiss.
Right. One thing I'd like to bring to both of your attention, because I know the briefing is probably done in the other case.
No, my opening brief is due in about another 30 to 60 days.
Okay. Perhaps both sides. We had a recent opinion called Harrison versus Reutemann about expert witness liability. If you two could maybe look at that. I don't know if it has any impact in this case at all, but it's recent and it might have some impact. So please, in the briefing, if you'd address that.
Yes,
like that.
Absolutely. And I would believe this is going to get into the sort of the issue as to there's always a danger that the underlying motions regarding expert fees or attorney's fees consumes or becomes greater than the actual dispute being adjudicated by the court in the first instance. And that is a concern.
We kind of understand the horse and the cart situation, but you're here today. Let's hear your position as the attorney's fees. We can put it in the bank and depending on what you do with the
attorney's fees. This is a case where really the outcome on the attorney's fee should be determined by the standard of review, and the standard of review is abuse of discretion. Now, I heard the court comment during appellant's argument that perhaps the district court did not conduct an analysis of the Brunzell factors. I don't think this court can go that far as to say that, and it reminds me of this court's multiple decisions with regard to what we call the Beatty factors as to whether or not attorney's fees should be awarded under an offer of judgment. And the court has held on numerous occasions that the failure of the district court on the record to walk through the Beatty factors in determining whether fees should be awarded under Rule 68
is not an indication that those factors were not considered by the district court, and I don't know why that same analysis would not apply to the Brunzell factors. I don't think it is necessary, after the parties have briefed the Brunzell factors, for the court on the record orally to walk through each and every one of them, just like it doesn't have to do with
the concern the court has is that a proper application of discretion by the district, by a court, is to at least give us a breadcrumb of how they got to their outcome, and not just re-reviewed it, but at least give us the plus or minus. Can be very cryptic, can be very summary, but for them to say we did this and there's nothing in the order and there's no oral finding, it leaves us as a reviewing court without any basis to make a decision.
I would disagree, because the court, if the court had awarded an amount different than what was being billed, I might agree with that analysis. But remember, the lodestar is a determination of the hours reasonably expended by a reasonable hourly rate. When the district court awards the hours spent with the rate actually charged, I believe that does give the court a basis for determining that this was the lodestar and this is how the court got there. The issue with the Lackey matrix, I provided supplemental authorities from the Ninth Circuit, which called it a question, and the Lackey matrix, and said it's questionable whether the Lackey matrix is even accurate in Alexandria, Virginia, across the river from Washington, D.C., much less 3,000 miles away, specifically held it is not an abuse of discretion. As I pointed out in the brief, Nye County and Esmeralda County, one which is larger than several eastern seaboard states, the second is probably the least populous county in the entire country, bear very little resemblance to the Denver, Phoenix, or Sacramento metropolitan areas. The relevant community under the Blum versus Stenson is the 5th Judicial District. And courts have always recognized, including the Chacon versus Lipke case cited in their brief, that the experienced trial judge is the best judge of the value of the professional services rendered in his court. Judge Walker has seen fee petitions before. Judge Walker has presided over insurance defense litigation. Judge Walker is an experienced judge and knows what the reasonable rate is for attorneys in the 5th Judicial District. This case can be decided based upon the failure of the appellant to place any evidence into the record as to what the prevailing market rate is in Pahrump, Nevada, where the case was heard. There were no affidavits from other attorneys, no billing statements from other attorneys in Pahrump. What the appellant has done is said, this is what I command as my highest rate in Las Vegas, and attempt to claim that the district court's refusal to accept that rate constitutes an abuse of discretion. It does not. The market rate is not the highest rate that an attorney can convince a client to pay him. The market rate is the reasonable value as determined by the relevant market. And insurance defense work is a market. It is no different than what I have to do. I have private pay clients that pay me a higher amount. I represent a number of unions who command, due to their market share and presence, a lower amount. And it's no different with...
What do you do with insurance firms that have in-house counsel and they're just being paid salaries and they're not billing the client? I thought about that in reading this case.
And there's plenty of cases that it says they're still entitled to a compensation at the reasonable market rate, and what you would do is then go out and look at the market and see what do insurance companies pay outside counsel.
That's how you want the market rate. And don't determine this quite often in the private sector, taking into consideration the fact that they may be based in a more metropolitan area and the trial is in a small rural community, which means a different type of time and effort away from the regular practice, so their fees change because they're traveling to Ely, Elko, or Power.
Correct, but if you go back to the case which has been relied upon by this court and all of the federal judiciary, the United States Supreme Court's decision in Blum versus Stetson, when you start with a lodestar analysis, you have to use the relevant community, which is the community in which the case is tried. I am not permitted to...
Do you use that? Well, we're talking federal standards more, so lodestar. Yeah, it's a little bit different in that category, but when we talk about states, especially small states, because they're very much more unique than the larger states, don't we then tend to examine it a little differently? Because sometimes you're dealing with a community that you can't take an airplane to, or it's a four-hour drive one way, you're away from your regular practice, or things of that nature. So you tell the client up front, I'm going to charge you something additional because I'm here instead of in the sunny confines of Reno or Las Vegas or something. Is that a consideration that the court may consider?
It is something the court may consider. Again, quoting from the case they rely upon, Jacon versus Litke, in effect, the court determines retrospectively whether the litigation involved a contingent risk or required extraordinary legal skill justifying augmentation of the unadorned lodestar. I think the concerns that you are articulating are exactly the sort of retrospective analysis that the court may take into account, but conversely, the court also has to look at the fact that the mere fact that I may choose to go hire a $1,000 an hour Wall Street lawyer to come litigate a case in Harlem, Nevada, doesn't automatically mean that his market rate is to translate to a rural jurisdiction. The defendant, a plaintiff, any party litigant, always has the option of hiring local counsel who is familiar with the court, somebody improper. There are attorneys of ground. I don't know if there's any in Esmeralda County other than Bob Beck at the DA, but there are attorneys in Nye County. The fact that they have chosen to hire one from Las Vegas or Reno does not mean that what they command in Reno or Las Vegas is appropriate, because it is the relevant community, the 5th Judicial District, not the 8th Judicial District, but the 2nd Judicial District, which is the relevant community. And in the absence, this is what I would emphasize, in the absence of the submission by Mr. Songer's attorneys as to what the market rate is for insurance defense work in the 5th Judicial District, the court naturally should default to the experience of the trial judge in having heard these sorts of cases. To borrow broadly, or do you need to cut you off?
I'm listening to you, and I'm listening to this experience of the trial judge. Since each trial judge may have a different experience, how do we get a level playing field in terms of figuring out this rate, opposed to having the parties submit what they think is reasonable in the communities for the judge to consider those, i.e. are going through Beatty and Brunzel?
That is the obligation of the moving party. That was the obligation of Mr. Garum in his fee petition to submit that sort of evidence. The federal judiciary makes us, when I win a case under 1983 or Title VII, go to my colleagues, Kathy England, and some of the other practitioners in employment law, and get affidavits as to what they charge and provide additional outside evidence as to what the prevailing rates are. Mr. Galen could have gone and obtained evidence to present to the district court to show what the prevailing market rate is. He did not do so. And that is why I think the judge defaults to her experience. Yes, different judges may have different experience. And I'm going to borrow very loosely from Potter Stewart's definition of pornography. When it comes to a reasonable rate, in the absence of anything else, an experienced trial judge knows it when they see it.
Which comes back to the point that you made earlier when we talked about a little bit, and that is, does a judge not have an obligation for looking at their experience to at least elucidate to the record why they're doing what they're doing so we don't have to guess?
They should. I would point out that she did, in fact, do so. What the appellant assigns as error, looking at the billing of Erickson, Thornton, and Swinston, the other law firm, is in fact a proper consideration under number two of Brunzel, which is the nature, character of the work actually performed. She looked at, well, how much time would the other attorney who had to engage in the exact same analysis for the exact same legal issues, how much time did they actually have to put in? and what, you know, what was the amount? And of course, if one had billed 10,000 hours for what the other billed 500 hours, then the court would have some concerns and would have to perhaps look deeper. But looking at what the co-defendant did is an indication that the court did consider the Brunzell factors because it would fall squarely under factor number two. And with that, I was concerned that I was not going to be able to use up 15 minutes on this case, and I don't think I have anything additional.
Thank you very much for your argument. Ms. Gutierrez?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, when I asked, how do you get a level playing field? And that's where the prevailing market rate and having these objective standards of the Laffey matrix or having an adjustment would really help to level that playing field, because it shouldn't be, well, you're doing insurance defense work. This was civil litigation. Judge Wanker had not dealt with this issue of anti-SLAPP, and in fact, if the concurrent appeal does get decided by this court, it's a matter of first impression. This was not your run-of-the-mill fender-bender auto insurance type case. This is a professional liability matter with large policy issues involving a heavy amount of research and briefing that Judge Wanker requested. And so knowing that this is really a civil matter that needs to be evaluated in the broader scope, not just going and saying, well, what does the insurance defense community do? What does the pro bono community do? You really need to look at what were the value provided in the matter, what did the attorneys do, the work conducted, and look at the whole picture. And so having a prevailing market rate in conjunction with the Brunzell factors would really be able to help this court make that determination as to whether or not the court actually considered those additional factors in awarding the fees. And unless the court has anything else?
In addition?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We thank counsel for our arguments today. We shed additional light on the subject matter presented. This matter will stand submitted.